A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's a non-US citizen married to an American. And like a lot of people in that situation, he's been handed a W-8 Ben form by some US company he's earning money from. Maybe YouTube ad revenue, maybe a podcast sponsor. His question is basically, what's this form actually doing? Why does it exist? And what traps should someone in his position watch out for if they want to stay in good standing with the IRS without accidentally becoming a US tax resident?
And the scenario he's describing is way more common than people realize. You're a Canadian YouTuber married to an American, you earn $500 from AdSense, and suddenly the IRS wants a form that feels almost like a loyalty oath. Declare under penalty of perjury that you aren't a US person. That's the W-8 Ben moment, and it catches a lot of people off guard.
It's also tightened considerably. FATCA enforcement is ramped up since 2023, and the IRS is cross-referencing spouse filings more aggressively than it used to. Get this wrong, and you could see your bank account frozen or a 30% withholding you. Never saw coming.
So let's start with what the form actually is. The W-8 Ben is a withholding certificate. It isn't a tax return. Under Section 1441 of the Internal Revenue Code, any U.S. payer, a company, a platform, whoever's cutting the check, must withhold 30% on most types of U.S. source income paid to a foreign person. Unless that foreign person certifies, they're eligible for a lower rate under a tax treaty. The W-8 Ben is that certification.
So the form's job is narrow. It says, I'm not a U.S. person, I live in this country, and under the treaty between that country and the U.S., my rate on this specific type of income is X percent, often zero for things like royalties or service income.
Right. And the form is valid for 3 years from the date you sign it. But here's the first thing most people miss. It's tied to your circumstances. The moment you become a U.S. resident, whether through a green card or the substantial presence test, the form is invalid immediately. You don't get to ride out the 3 years.
And marriage to a U.S. citizen doesn't automatically trigger residency. That's a common misconception. But the substantial presence test, which counts your days of physical presence in the U.S., has a special exemption for spouses that a lot of people misinterpret.
The substantial presence test says you're a U.S. resident for tax purposes if you're physically present in the U.S. for 31 days in the current year, plus a weighted count of the two prior years. But there's something called the closer connection exception. If you're present for fewer than 183 days in the current year, and you maintain a tax home in a foreign country to which you have a closer connection, you can avoid being treated as a resident. Being married to a U.S. citizen complicates proving that closer connection to the foreign country, but it doesn't automatically defeat it.
So, the W-8BEN in isolation is a simple form with a simple job. But here's where marriage to a U.S. citizen turns that simplicity into a minefield.
The big one is Section 6013G of the Internal Revenue Code. This says a non-resident alien married to a U.S. citizen or resident alien can elect to be treated as a resident alien for tax purposes. You do this by filing a joint return. It sounds helpful. Joint filing often means lower rates, the standard deduction, eligibility for certain credits. But the moment you make that election, you're now reporting your worldwide income to the IRS. That's the exact opposite of what the W-8 Ben certifies.
So if you've signed a W-8 Ben with your U.S. payer, and then you and your spouse decide to file jointly that year, your W-8 Ben is void. You've declared under penalty of perjury that you're a non-resident foreign person, and then you filed a tax return saying the opposite.
And the IRS will notice. Let me walk through a concrete example. A German freelancer married to a U.S. citizen earns $2,000 a year from a U.S. podcast sponsor. She signs a W-8 Ben claiming the Germany-U.S. treaty rate of 0% for royalties, which is correct under the treaty if she's a non-resident. But if she and her spouse file jointly in the U.S. that year, that treaty claim is now invalid. She's a U.S. resident for tax purposes and owes U.S. tax on her global income, including her German clients. The IRS's automated underreporter system will flag the mismatch between the W-8 bin on file with the payor and the joint return.
And that's the AUR system. It cross-references W-8BEBEBEN filings, FATCA data, and tax returns to flag inconsistencies. The IRS doesn't have a formal compliance score like a credit rating, but it maintains a compliance history through that system. If it sees forms that contradict each other, you get flagged for an audit.
Now let's add FATCA to this picture, because this is where things get even more entangled. The Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act requires foreign financial institutions to report accounts held by U.S. persons to the IRS. If your spouse is a U.S. citizen, any joint account you hold, a checking account in London, a savings account in Toronto, an investment account in Frankfurt, that foreign bank must report it. Your name, the account balance, your transaction history, all visible to the IRS even if you never file a U.S. return.
And the W-8 bin doesn't protect you from FATCA reporting. That's one of the biggest misconceptions out there. People think signing a W-8 bin puts a wall between them and the IRS. It doesn't. It only affects withholding on U.S. source income. FATCA reporting on joint accounts is entirely independent.
I saw this play out in a case that's instructive. A UK-based podcaster married to a U.S. citizen. She files a W-8 bin with Patreon claiming the UK treaty rate. Her husband files as married filing separately to avoid pulling her into the U.S. tax system, which is a perfectly legitimate choice. But their joint UK bank account triggers FATCA reporting. The IRS sees the account, sees no U.S. return from her, and sends a CP2000 notice proposing tax on the entire account balance. Not because she owes it, but because the system assumes the worst when it sees unreported accounts.
And the fix in that case is to file Form 8833, the treaty. Base return position disclosure, to explain the treaty exemption. But that notice takes 18 months to resolve. 18 months of correspondence, documentation, and anxiety, all because of a mismatch between what FATCA reported and what the IRS expected to see.
The CP2000 notice is the IRS's automated underreporter notice. It's not an audit in the formal sense. It's a computer-generated letter that says, "We have information that doesn't match your return. Here's what we think you owe." But resolving it can be just as painful as an audit, especially from abroad.
So, let's talk about the ITIN, because this is the practical hurdle that trips up a lot of people in Daniel's situation. If your spouse files jointly and elects to treat you as a resident, you need an individual taxpayer identification number. That's Form W-7.
And the ITIN application process is genuinely painful from abroad. You need to provide original or certified copies of your foreign passport, not a photocopy. The IRS wants originals or copies certified by the issuing agency. Processing times in 2025 averaged 11 weeks, and rejection rates for incomplete documentation have been climbing since 2024.
11 weeks without your passport, if you mail the original. For someone living abroad, that's not just inconvenient. It can be impossible if you need to travel for work or family.
The workaround is a certified acceptance agent. The IRS maintains a list of these by country. A CAA can verify your passport in person and forward the certification to the IRS, so you never have to mail the original document. This cuts processing time and eliminates the risk of lost documents. If you're outside the U.S. and need an ITIN, this isn't optional. It's the only sane way to do it.
And here's a knock-on effect that catches people off guard. Many non-citizen spouses file jointly for 1 year, maybe to claim the child tax credit, which can be substantial, without realizing they've potentially complicated their status for future years.
The election under Section 6013G is technically per year. You can choose to file jointly 1 year and not the next, but the IRS may challenge a pattern of alternating statuses as tax avoidance. And more importantly, once you've filed jointly, you've established a U.S. tax presence. The IRS now has your ITIN, your worldwide income from that year, and an expectation that you'll continue filing. If you stop, and FATCA data keeps showing joint accounts with your U.S. spouse, the AUR system is going to flag it.
So the practical rule is, if you file jointly once, assume the IRS will expect consistency going forward. You can stop, but be prepared to explain why, and file a protective return to establish that you're compliant, even if you owe nothing.
Let's talk about that protective return, because it's one of the most useful tools in this space. Form 1040-NR is the U.S. non-resident alien income tax return, even if you owe zero U.S. tax. Because all your income is foreign source and you're not a U.S. resident, you can file a 1040-NR to establish that you're compliant. This prevents the IRS from assuming the worst when FATCA data arrives showing joint accounts.
Think of it as a preemptive strike. The IRS is computers see a joint account with a U.S. citizen spouse. They expect to see a return. If they don't see one, they assume unreported income. A protective return says, here's my return. Here's why I owe nothing. Here's the treaty provision that exempts me. Now the computer has an answer instead of a gap.
And that brings us to Form 8833, which I mentioned earlier. This is the treaty-based return position disclosure. It's a niche form that a lot of preparers miss, but it's the correct way to avoid double taxation without invalidating your W-8. Here's how it works. You're filing jointly with your U.S. spouse, which makes you a resident alien for tax purposes. But under the tax treaty between the U.S. and your home country, certain types of your foreign income may still be exempt from U.S. tax. You file Form 8833 to disclose that you're taking a treaty position that overrides the normal tax code.
So, the form is essentially saying, yes, I'm filing as a resident, but under Article whatever of the U.S.-UK Treaty or the U.S.-Germany Treaty, my foreign self-employment income is only taxable in my country of residence, which isn't the U.S. for treaty purposes, even though I'm filing as a resident for tax purposes.
And this is where the distinction between tax residency and treaty residency matters. You can be a U.S. resident for tax purposes under the Internal Revenue Code, but still be a resident of your home country under the treaty's tiebreaker rules. The treaty can override the code in specific situations, and Form 8833 is how you tell the IRS you're doing that.
So we've covered the mechanics. Now let's talk about what happens when the IRS's computers start connecting the dots between your W-8BEN, your spouse's return, and your joint bank account.
The IRS has been modernizing its systems under what it calls the Digital First Initiative. The goal is real-time data matching across all the information streams the IRS receives. W-8 bins from payers, FATCA reports from foreign banks, FBAR filings for foreign accounts, tax returns from your spouse. The AUR system is getting faster and more aggressive at flagging inconsistencies.
And the consistency across all these forms is the single most important thing. If your W-8BDEN says you're a non-resident foreign person living in Germany, your spouse's return shouldn't claim you as a joint filer. If your spouse files separately, your joint account should still be reported properly. If you do file jointly, your W-8BEN with any U.S. payer needs to be revoked and replaced, probably with a W-9, which is the U.S. person equivalent.
Let me be specific about that, because the W-8BEN versus W-9 distinction is where a lot of people create problems for themselves. If you've elected to be treated as a resident alien by filing jointly, you're now a U.S. person for tax purposes for that year. You can't have an active W-8BEN on file with any U.S. payer. You need to provide a W-9 instead. If you don't, and the payer continues to treat you as a foreign person with zero withholding, you're under withheld, and the IRS will come looking for that tax.
And payers don't automatically know your status changed. You have to tell them. They'll keep treating you under whatever form you last gave them until it expires or you update it.
Right. The W-8BEN has a 3-year validity window, but the onus is on you to inform the payer if your circumstances change before that window closes. The form itself says this in the instructions. You must notify the withholding agent within 30 days of becoming a U.S. person.
So, let's walk through the 4 concrete things someone in Daniel's position should do. And Daniel, if you're listening, this is the practical takeaway section.
Number 1. Never sign a W-8BIN and a joint return in the same tax year. If you want to file jointly, you must first revoke your W-8BIN with the payer and accept that you're now a U.S. tax resident for that year, with all the global reporting that entails. You can't have it both ways.
Number 2. If you have joint accounts with your U.S. spouse, assume the IRS knows about them. FACA reporting means your name and balance are already in the system. File a protective return, Form 1040-NR, even if you owe no tax, to establish that you're compliant. This prevents the IRS from assuming the worst when FATCA data arrives.
Number 3. Use a certified acceptance agent for your ITIN application. The IRS maintains a list of CAAs by country on its website. They can verify your passport without you mailing the original anywhere. This isn't a luxury. If you're abroad and need an ITIN, this is the baseline approach.
Number 4. Keep what I'd call a compliance diary. A simple spreadsheet tracking every W-8BEN you've signed. The date, the payer, the treaty rate claimed. Every year you've filed or not filed a U.S. return, and what form you used. Every joint account with your U.S. spouse, including the institution, an approximate balance. If the IRS ever audits you, this documentation proves good faith and consistency. It shows you weren't hiding anything. You were navigating a complex system.
And good faith matters enormously in tax compliance. The difference between an honest mistake and willful neglect can be the difference between a corrected return and substantial penalties. A compliance diary is your evidence of good faith.
Let me add one more that's less obvious. If you're the non-citizen spouse and you have no U.S. income, but your U.S. citizen spouse has U.S. income and files jointly with you, you can use Form 8833 to claim treaty exemptions on your foreign income. This is the correct way to avoid double taxation without invalidating your non-resident status for treaty purposes. Most preparers miss this form because it's not part of the standard joint filing package. You have to know to ask for it.
And that form isn't just for exotic situations. If you're a UK citizen with UK self-employment income, married to a US citizen, and you file jointly, the US-UK treaty says your UK self-employment income is only taxable in the UK unless you have a permanent establishment in the US. Form 8833 is how you tell the IRS you're claiming that treaty position. Without it, the IRS assumes all your worldwide income is fair game.
Which brings us back to the W-8BEN and what it's actually doing. It's a declaration of non-residency, but marriage to a U.S. citizen creates a gravitational pull toward U.S. tax residency. The key is knowing when you've crossed the line and having a plan for both sides of it.
And the line isn't always obvious. You can live your entire life outside the U.S., never set foot in the country, and still find yourself drawn into the U.S. tax system through your spouse's citizenship. FATCA sees your joint accounts. The AUR system sees your spouse's return. The W-8BEN you signed 3 years ago is sitting in some payer's records. All these data points are converging.
One thing we haven't touched on is the State Department side of this. U.S. citizens are required to enter and leave the U.S. on a U.S. passport. If your spouse is a U.S. citizen and you're traveling together, that's straightforward. But if you're a non-citizen spouse and you're entering the U.S., your tax compliance history can affect your admissibility. Not directly through the tax code, but through the general good moral character assessment that applies to visa applications and green card petitions.
That's an important point. The IRS and USCIS don't share data directly in a routine way, but if you ever apply for a green card or citizenship, your tax compliance history becomes relevant. The N-400 naturalization application asks about tax filing history. Inconsistencies between your W-8BEN filings and your tax returns could surface as questions about your honesty in government filings.
So the compliance diary isn't just for IRS audits. It's for any future interaction with the U.S. government where your tax history might be relevant.
Let me address one more misconception that comes up a lot. Some people think, I don't live in the U.S., so the IRS has no jurisdiction over me. That's not how it works. If you sign a W-8BEN, you're submitting to U.S. tax authority for that income. If you file jointly with a U.S. spouse, you're submitting to full U.S. tax jurisdiction. The IRS absolutely has jurisdiction over the U.S. source income of non-resident aliens, and it has jurisdiction over anyone who voluntarily files a U.S. tax return.
And the 30% withholding rate that applies if you don't submit a W-8BEN. That's not a penalty. That's the default statutory rate under Section 41. The W-8BEN is your way of saying, I qualify for a lower rate. Here's why. Without it, the payer has no choice but to withhold the full 30%.
which, for a small creator earning a few hundred or a few thousand dollars from a US platform, is a meaningful chunk of revenue. If you're earning $5,000 a year from YouTube and you don't submit a W-8 BNI, the platform withholds $1,500. You might get some of that back by filing the US return and claiming a treaty refund, but that's a whole separate process, and it requires an ITI team.
So, the W-8 BEN is actually the easier path, as long as you're a non-resident and you're not filing jointly. The form itself is straightforward. The complexity comes from the interaction with your spouse's U.S. tax obligations.
And that's really the core of what Daniel's asking about. The W-8 BEN in isolation is a simple form. But he's not in isolation. He's married to a U.S. citizen, which means every form he signs exists in relation to his spouse's tax profile. The IRS sees them together, even if they file separately.
There's another practical consideration for people who run their own businesses. If you're a non-citizen spouse with a sole proprietorship or a single-member LLC in your home country, and you file jointly with your U.S. spouse, that business may now be reportable to the IRS. Not just the income. The entity itself may trigger Form 5472 or other foreign entity reporting requirements.
Form 5472 is the information return of a 25% foreign-owned U.S. corporation or a foreign corporation engaged in a U.S. trade or business. But even if that specific form doesn't apply, the general principle does. Once you're in the U.S. tax system as a resident, your foreign business entities become reportable in ways they weren't before.
Which is why the decision to file jointly should never be made casually. The tax savings from joint filing might be a few thousand dollars. The compliance burden of reporting foreign entities, foreign accounts, and worldwide income can be substantial, and the cost of getting it wrong can be much larger than the tax savings.
And here's the thing about the child tax credit, which is often the reason non-citizen spouses agree to file jointly. The credit can be worth up to $2,000 per child, and a portion of it's refundable. For a family with two kids, that's $4,000. That's real money. But you need to weigh that against the compliance costs, the I-10 application, the potential need for professional tax preparation, the ongoing filing obligations. For some families, it's worth it. For others, especially if the non-citizen spouse has significant foreign income or complex foreign assets, it may not be.
And if you do go the joint filing route, you need professional help. This isn't TurboTax territory. You need a preparer who understands both U.S. tax law and the tax treaty with your home country, and who knows about Form 8833. That's a narrow slice of the profession.
The IRS does maintain a directory of federal tax return preparers with credentials and qualifications. You can search by country and specialty. For someone in Daniel's position, an enrolled agent or CPA with international expertise is the minimum standard, not a seasonal preparer at a chain.
All of this sounds overwhelming, but the four steps we outlined earlier really do cover most of the risk. Don't mix W-8 BENs and joint returns. Assume FATCA visibility on joint accounts. Use a certified acceptance agent for ITIN applications. Keep a compliance diary. Those four things will keep you in good standing with the IRS, even if you never set foot in the country.
And one more, if you're ever unsure, file a protective return. Form 1040-NR with zero tax due is infinitely better than silence when the IRS's computers are looking at FATCA data showing your name on a joint account.
The W-8B BEN is a declaration of non-residency, but marriage to a U.S. citizen creates a gravitational pull toward U.S. tax residency. The key is knowing when you've crossed the line, and having a plan for both sides of it.
Here's an open question I've been thinking about. The IRS's Digital First initiative is pushing toward real-time data matching. As that system matures, will the W-8 BEN eventually become obsolete? If FATCA data tells the IRS in real time that you're a foreign person with a treaty country residence, and your spouse's return tells them you're not filing jointly, the W-8 BEN becomes redundant. The IRS already knows everything the form would tell them.
The form might go away, but the compliance obligations won't. The underlying rules, the 30% default withholding, the treaty rate claims, the residency elections, those are statutory. The form is just the paperwork layer on top.
And that's really the deeper point. Daniel's question was about the W-8 BEN, but the real question is about navigating the system that sees cross-border families as edge cases, even though there are millions of them. The forms are designed for clear categories: U.S. person or foreign person, resident or non-resident, but marriage across those categories creates ambiguity that the forms don't handle well.
The system wants bright lines. Marriage to a U.S. citizen blurs them. The compliance diary, the protective return, the careful separation of W-8B bends and joint returns, all of these are ways of creating your own bright lines where the system fails to provide them. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In Edo period Japan, sumptuary laws dictated the maximum acoustic brightness of a merchant's footwear, specifically the volume at which wooden clogs could strike the street, with violators subject to fines calculated in units of rice. The reasoning was that loud footsteps implied an unseemly degree of haste, which was considered socially disruptive and above one's station.
I have so many questions, and I'm not sure I want any of them answered.
The fines were in rice. Of course they were.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps more people find the show. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.